is the Grinlian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinlian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grinlian Bunker. Somewhere out there in that dark disquiet known only to those in the know as the Mohorovicic Continuity, or discontinuity. I ain't dissing the discontinuity here. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the one and only Grinlian Report. Thank you so much for being here with us. All of you listeners out there in the twilight world of Fortiana who come here every week to hear the latest news that's going on in the world of the unexplained. And tonight, we will be looking at a wide range of interesting phenomena, including scientists who are studying Sasquatch, one man who claims that he is actually having an ongoing, interactive, live and in real time discussion with Bigfoot, and other things, various and asunder, related to the big one. That's, as you know, an interesting subject to me. I hope it's just as interesting to you. A lot of people dismiss it, but why call something mythical when there may actually be good evidence to support it? In fact, I talked a little about that last night on a program while I was on the airwaves with Mr. Jimmy Church. It was an interesting conversation. We may revisit a little of that, but I'll tell you something else that's been on my mind. Might as well get to it first. And I'd promised my Grinlian X listeners we'd talk about this. I touched on it very briefly last night in the little amount of time that we had toward the end of the Micah Hanks radio show on KGRA. But for my Grinlian listenership, the thousands of you out there, and some of whom aren't able to catch the Micah Hanks show, their schedule doesn't work out or they don't get the podcast, you know, so it's not to be redundant. But this is interesting because I've been telling everybody, you know, I've been putting this out on social media. I have been talking about it on the various programs I do. God, how many are there now? Hard to keep track. You know, Middle Theory's back. That's right. The Mouth and McNonymous have returned. And apparently there was some sort of an issue with the RSS feed. But, you know, I always thought that that program was one that primarily, you know, fed off of kind of Grinlian listeners. You would not believe, first of all, the podcast grew in popularity so quickly. And also, there were so many people who said, you know, I found the Grinlian Report through being a listener of Middle Theory. Well, if you are one of those people, you'll be happy to know that the middle ground, the radical center, has returned. And boy, it's an interesting return. As a matter of fact, you know, I'm a little tempted actually just to give people a little bit of a sneak preview right now, just so that you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And then we'll make our segue into what's been going on out there over California. But this is why you need to listen to the return of Middle Theory. The RSS feed was acting up. I think we've got it operational now. The new episode's up on Stitcher. It's live at middletheory.com. And you're also going to see it over there on iTunes, hopefully within the next few hours just as well. But this, I'm going to give you about 2 minutes worth of why you need to listen to this new episode of Middle Theory.
Galaxy, 36.7 light years from Earth, to be exact, on a substellar space rock orbiting the star known to Earthlings as Arcturus. It's been 6 months, St. Paddy's Day in fact, since the man known to the world as Mr. McNonymous was last seen leaving an Italian restaurant 2 blocks from Central Park, New York. How he ended up here? Nobody, and probably not even he, really knows. But what is known is that a search party has been combing the asteroid belt for months, looking for signs of his whereabouts. And that's a good thing, because right now, he isn't in the best company.
Oh, too much dad juice. Where am I?
The prisoner is awake!
What is this place?
You will tell us about your secret society!
What? What are you talking about?
The world's most secret society!
Oh, God. You're kidding.
You will tell us or you will be exterminated.
Look, that's not what you think.
You will tell us.
I'll tell you nothing. You can torture me. You can even kill me with that plunger thing. But I have powerful friends, and they will come looking for me.
You have no friends here, podcaster.
Oh, yeah? Well, if I don't have friends, then who the hell is that?
The Doctor?
No. Well, something like that.
Mr. Magnanimous! There you are. I've been looking everywhere for you. Look, grab onto this ladder.
Wait, this is a tentacle.
Look, don't ask questions right now. Just come on. Like I said, you may want to go check this out. It's probably going to be a really good time for you. Middle Theory returns. And as we do, we head directly into darkness. Of course, the whole premise of that program is that unlike the Graylian Report, which focuses almost entirely on the unexplained, the Middle Theory program looks at news and world events, and we try to make sense of the madness without the politicization that you generally hear on mainstream news outlets. And so that's what we pride ourselves in being able to do. I've seen people in the chat room talking about the voices there. Yes, indeed. Magnanimous was kidnapped by aliens, familiar to some Whovians out there probably. And yeah, that was a real interesting rescue operation. Glad I was able to pull it off by the skin of my teeth, by the skin of Dergopal. Now, that said, speaking of things that fly through the sky, like our lovely gelatinous lady of the clouds, there is something very strange that has been reported recently over California. And this one's really got me, you know, kind of turning over in my mind the possibilities. And last night on the Micah Hanks radio program, I kind of canvassed the history of airship phenomena in relation to what's been going on for really more than a century in California. Now, not to say that it's all related, because that's probably not the case. In truth, probably what's happening in California is a variety of phenomena that have been, well, that have variously at times involved blimps. And that does not necessarily always mean that there are ufological causes underlying. But we do know that, of course, there were the reports of alleged airships that began to surface around the turn of the last century, 1896, 1897. Those reports spread out kind of across the United States and headed eastward. And it was largely believed that these were newspaper hoaxes. Although there are certain scholars who maintain that while the majority of them probably are, that some of the reports of the alleged airships still remain of interest, and there may be something to them. J. Allen Danilek wrote a book about that. We actually had him on the program here just, I think, well, it's been a couple of years, actually. But a very interesting book, The Great Airship Mystery of 1897. So that's something worthy of looking at for people. Well, I got an email from one of our listeners just in the last few days, and if you head over to MicahHanks.com, you'll see an article that's titled, Are Stealth Blimps Being Seen Over California? And it's one of the most interesting reports that has come in a while. And I think, as I mentioned at the end of this article, I kind of have an idea, I think, of what maybe is going on in relation to this one. But I can't be 100% certain. It's only really whispers and rumors about different kinds of projects and things that are going on. But this is the story, and Jason McCraw is the fellow who actually sent this email along. He and I have corresponded a bit, and he gave me permission to use his name and also to tell this story, and it's a good one. He says, about 1 month ago, my girlfriend and I went on a late-night donut run around 11:30 p.m. local time and witnessed something the likes of which neither of us had ever seen before. Now, this was right on the main boulevard in our town, so when we exited the car in the parking lot, there were a fair amount of cars still driving around and just no other foot traffic as far as I could see. Now, we both were halfway through our cigarettes, so we decided to stand in the otherwise empty parking lot and finish them before going in. It was then that my girlfriend noticed two flashing white lights ascend from behind a range of hills approximately 70 miles to the south of where we stood. Now, one was leading, and the other was following. In fact, it was pacing the first one so perfectly, it was as if it was attached to the first one by a tow rope. Now listen carefully, this is where this starts to get really strange. The longer we watched as they straightened out and approached us, the stranger they looked. There was no sound, no wings, just gigantic blimp-shaped objects with one flashing white light at the nose. They floated pretty fast, too, and they were too large to be blimps. And as they passed us directly overhead, you could make out their slightly off-white color in the flashing of the lights. And they looked kind of worn. Older. The strangest thing, though, was that they continued to float past one after the other
And as they did, they released a single cluster of bright blue lights from their tail ends. There was no sound, definitely not blue ice. These lights were clustered and almost plasma-like in appearance. They were ejected directly over the center of town. They only stayed lit for a second before disappearing midair in the blink of an eye. The objects then continued on their straight line until they were out of sight behind a low mountain range to the south. Now, I'm writing because maybe you've heard a similar story to this one before. Maybe someone else out there has seen something kind of like this. Now, I was immediately intrigued by this story, as I think most researchers of Fortiana probably would be. And as I was reading over this, I thought immediately, you know, it would be maybe a good idea to get in touch with the internet or the National UFO Reporting Center that's maintained by Peter Davenport. And at the website of the National UFO Reporting Center, there was one report that took place. This was near Beaumont, where Jason and his girlfriend saw these kind of worn-looking, older-looking, off-white and huge, silent, blimp-shaped objects. Really, really weird. But about an hour and a half away, I think northwest near Palmdale, a report that was made to the National UFO Reporting Center described an individual who said that they were driving home from a friend's house and witnessed a grayish circle object in the distance that had been moving at a high rate of speed across the night. Now, again, that's a bit of a vague description, and so we couldn't really necessarily draw a conclusive link between the two, but there was an object that was seen nearby on the same evening that seemed perplexing to that individual. Now, Adam in the chat room has mentioned the plasma coming from their tail ends. And I'm telling you, it is interesting. It is a rather interesting description. And I'm trying to think of about this. You know, what exactly are we seeing here? Because if these were blimps, you know, nothing that would be akin to bluish sparks of light would be appearing in relation to these blimps. It was extremely strange, a very weird component to this report. And in the article that I wrote at MicahHanks.com about this, I do cite an Examiner article that had been written by the Los Angeles National Security Examiner reporter named Michael Webster, and here's what he had written. I think this was just earlier this year, in fact. He writes that the United States Defense Department claims that it is readying itself to issue contracts for the construction of a sophisticated, ultra-high-altitude, 450-plus-foot-long blimp that will hover above the Earth's surface at 65,000 feet and remain airborne for up to 10 years. I mean, this thing just stays in the sky. Now, many are skeptical and believe that this spy airship actually already exists or that one like it may already be in operation now. All across the U.S. and around the world, the public has reported seeing large airships flying low, believed to be taking off or landing. Most are reported seen near military airfields. The strange, huge airships have also been reported being seen near the top-secret base called Area 51 in Nevada and north of Las Vegas. Now, it's pretty interesting to me because, you know, there are a lot of these kinds of reports and stories about these, again, what are described as being extremely large cigar-shaped objects. There's actually a much longer, older history of this, though, in relation to UFO reports. And I even talk about some of these kinds of giant cigar-type UFOs in my book, The Ghost Rockets. You know, damned if I know, on the whole, really what these things might represent, what we might be actually dealing with here. But it seems to me that there's probably, if not one, several varieties of stealth blimp kind of technology. Some of them stealth only in that they're supposed to reside at an extremely high altitude and, like we said, stay up there for 10 years for surveillance purposes. And this is something that would be so high up that most people wouldn't even be able to see it, let alone be paying attention to it. But, again, it seems interesting to me, this report that Jason brings to the table. And, again, it due in part to the camaraderie that is taking place recently between Jim Harold and I, teaming up and doing our video show, The Paranormal Report, each week, you know, the relaunch of Middle Theory, you know, cooperation with the KGRA. We provide an awful lot of programming, and of course, there's Graylian X for people who enjoy something else. Speaking of something else, this month's Graylian X will be out in just a few days, and it is tentatively titled, this will actually be the title, but I say tentatively only because it hasn't been released yet, but it's Wings Over West Virginia. And it doesn't just tell the story of Mothman. I think we all know that story. It's going to look a little more deeply at what may have been going on over Point Pleasant and in Point Pleasant, and what actually brought John Keel there in the late 1960s. This mythos of Mothman built around it, but there was a lot more going on. And so we offer that, of course, just as well to subscribers. Really, really good quality stuff and a lot of it. And through all this, I mean, it's really just been exponential growth. It's really helped the Graylian Report, you know, just to continue growing. And literally, we have been picking up listeners by the thousands. I mean, more quickly than ever before. Every month. I thank you guys, by the way, for telling your friends and for sharing what we do and expressing to people that you enjoy this program and that others should listen to it. But with that huge reach, you know, I do believe that there is a certain element of responsibility that comes into play. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we all, by virtue of being listeners together, we are able to share a lot of information. And so I rely on people who listen to this program to share information with me. Jason did, and he brought to the table a really interesting story of these two incredible airships. You know, if you've seen anything like that, I'd like to hear from you. You know, but really anything, you know, whether it be something that's related to, you know, airships or, you know, anything ufological, whether it be, something having to do with government secrecy or spying, you know, and, you know, concerns over, you know, a police state. We talk about that from time to time on the program just as well. You know, and Edward Snowden related things. You know, if you've got an opinion or an idea to offer, if you're interested in Bigfoot, you know, or if you've got another story idea or even a guest you'd like to hear on the program, you know, those are all things you can send along to us. info@graylianreport.com is how you do it. We'll be getting to a break in just a minute, but first, a few things that are going on elsewhere in the world that are in the news. Speaking of weird things in the sky, what has been described as a blazing meteor apparently lit up the sky like fireworks over parts of the eastern United States on Monday night. Did you see it? I didn't see this one, but I have seen security footage, and I'm going to tell you right now, in certain locations, it turned night into day. This thing was huge. There were more than 200 sighting reports, according to the American Meteor Society. Now, it entered the Earth's atmosphere over central Pennsylvania late on Sunday night, early Sunday morning, or Monday morning, while observers from Virginia all the way to Massachusetts in what is described as a random fireball event. Now, most of the people who reported the fireball said that it began as a brilliant white color, but get this, then it turned yellow, then it turned green, and then it turned orange, multicolors. You don't see that an awful lot. Now, a witness in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, had said that the meteor traveled like a bottle rocket from the clouds straight to the ground. The eastern sky, it lit up, and it went off like a firework, and then it was gone. Another person from Plains, Virginia, said it was the biggest, the very biggest that they had ever seen. It looked like a transformer blew up, according to one witness in Mount Wolf, Pennsylvania. Now, if you heard from that, or if you actually saw this thing, I'd like to hear from you. That would be interesting just as well. Hear what you saw. Apparently, it was quite the spectacle in the sky. Something else that's sure to be a spectacle of sorts just as well. Apparently, this has been news for some time. I just saw the story carried by BBC News about an hour ago. Leonardo DiCaprio, actor who has appeared in course of films such as The Great Gatsby, Django Unchained, a lot of films. And I think truly he's a fine actor just as well. And he is apparently also now going to be a representative to the UN on the subject of climate change. That's right. The Hollywood actor has been appointed a United Nations representative on climate change. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said that the actor's global stardom was the perfect match for the global challenge that he says is posed by climate change. His first duty, Mr. DiCaprio, that is, will be apparently to address the opening of the climate summit later this month in New York. That'll be interesting, I'm sure. Now, something else also, a bit of a spectacle that's in the news this evening. You know, we know about the Architeuthis, the giant squid, and there are other varieties of extremely large squids out there just as well, such as the colossal squid. And one in the possession of marine biologists is going to be thawed for examination in New Zealand. Now, get this, they've started to examine this rare squid that had been found in the Antarctic by fishermen. After being frozen for preservation, it has now been decided to go ahead and defrost this thing so that scientists can take a good look at it. And it's thought to extend beyond 4 meters from tip to tentacle. That's about 13 feet. Dr. Kat Bolstad of the Auckland University of Technology described the specimen as very big and very beautiful. We've talked many times in the past about what I call deep sea gigantism and the apparent propensity for large life forms to evolve and to exist in the deepest depths of the ocean. And why? What is it about that? What is it about the deep depths of our oceans that is so conducive to life. Well, you know, it could be pressure, of course, at those depths, and generally in an aqueous environment like that, let alone a saltwater environment, that is generally more conducive to supporting the massive weight of an extremely large animal. There are a lot of factors that contribute to large animals. And as we've said before in the past, and from time to time I realize I do have to repeat myself because I'll get emails from people, you know, who are commenting on something that's been talked about on the program some, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks ago. And I want to say, well, are you listening to the most recent editions of the program? You know, I do. I get emails about things that popped up on the program sometimes months ago, years ago. I guess we're time travelers. But this is something we've discussed in the past. And again, scientists speculate that there may be more than 70 species, and relatively large ones too, of new animal, or maybe varieties of animal that are identified and known to exist, but different varieties, species within those general classes of animals that are as yet unidentified by science. And sometimes they bear such similarity to known varieties of species that this is how they actually maintain their anonymity, as it were, their aqueous anonymity for so long. But I would maintain that there probably are also other things out there, really, really weird stuff. You know that Enigmas episode for the Graylian X subscribers out there that we did about that great sea serpent that was seen, I believe, in the 1850s. And some of the incredible reports and the consistency between the reports of these animals that are described. Even the parts of the world down there around the Cape of Good Hope, where these things were consistently seen, especially around that time. But even today, still, there are a good few reports that come in from time to time that we hear that seem to indicate that there are large reptile-like marine animals. Whatever they may be, they definitely match the descriptions of what are called sea serpents, historically, colloquially, and in myth and legend. And I can't help but think that sometimes there's just a little bit more going on out there than most of us are fully aware of. And that's exactly what a few scientists right now are talking about in relation to Bigfoot. And when we come back from this break, we're going to talk a little bit about the science of Bigfoot and also some of the more wild and speculative stuff that's going on in the field. I never cease to be amazed by this discussion, the ongoing debate over whether there is something almost human, almost like you or I, that exists out there, but in our remote wilds. We'll talk about that when we come back here on the Graylian Report. High mountains of Appalachia. It is the Graylian Report, and I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Glad as always to be here with you on a Tuesday night. Then again, of course, for those of you who download the podcast, it could be any time, any place, any space, and that's what we love. Rather timeless little shindig that we do here every week on the Graylian Report. Now, as I was discussing in the last segment, there are a group of scientists who have had Bigfoot on their brain for quite some time. And the story was sent along to me by one of our Graylian newsies. Fox News Latino actually carried it, and the story goes that 70 scientists from around the world are meeting at an event to discuss Bigfoot, which actually, again, came up while I was on the radio program with Jimmy Church last night. And Jimmy, we had a great time together. Great talking, great fielding calls from the listeners. And at one point, Bigfoot came up, which we'll get back around to discussing here in a moment, but the story about the 70 scientists was interesting to me because, you know, we typically don't hear about people who, you know, are identifying themselves as being academics who are also advocates of Bigfoot belief. I even had a few issues with some of the ideas expressed in this article. But Foxnews.com in the Latino section actually carried this. And again, it reads that 70 scientists from around the world defying widespread skepticism have been involved for the past 4 decades in the search for Bigfoot, the large and hairy beast allegedly seen in remote areas of the United States. Now, Rettman Mullis, founder and chair of the Western Bigfoot Society, has said, "We're different from other Bigfoot researchers in the sense that we start with the certainty that Bigfoot exists." So we focus our studies on its behavior and classification within the animal kingdom, Rettman said. Now, that's an interesting statement. We're different from other Bigfoot researchers in the sense that we start with the certainty that Bigfoot exists. Can we be certain that Bigfoot exists? That's an interesting question. What do you think? I'll let you stew over that as we're looking at this. But now, I don't know that I would agree with entering with a predisposition toward belief or disbelief, for that matter. But I think that the idea that they're trying to express is a good one. Picking up the second half of that quote, quote, "So we focus our studies on its behavior and classification within the animal kingdom, rather than the burden of trying to find proof." Now, I have said since the outset, dating back, I think, to around 2004, when I started actually publishing articles about this, that if we could suspend disbelief long enough about the Bigfoot question to suppose that something actually existed, and if we looked at the anecdotal evidence and tried to draw information from that evidence, we might learn things about the habits of these creatures that would bring us back to square one in trying to solve that ultimate first riddle: does Bigfoot even exist? So while I don't know that I am comfortable with the idea of going into it with a sense that there is certainty, as cited here by Mr. Rettman, that Bigfoot exists, I don't know that I would advocate certainty and belief of its existence, but I do agree with the idea that maybe we should suspend disbelief at times so that we could move forward in a logical way and in a discerning manner that would utilize evidence before us already and try and make sense of it. Now, it is impossible to estimate how many of these creatures live in the world, according to Mullis, but I would say that just in North America there may be about 100,000 of them. Now, the Pacific Northwest and Washington State is where the Bigfoot Society, who is basically this organization that we're discussing here, they're based in the Pacific West and Northwest and Washington State, which is kind of traditionally the hotbed of Bigfoot activity. But, you know, the phenomenon is not relegated solely to that area geographically. That's certainly not the case. Now, Mullis has said that he has been fascinated by Bigfoot since childhood when he saw one of the creatures for the first time. He says, "I saw one with my own eyes. It was 1977, and it happened in Puget Sound in Washington State, and that changed my life forever." Now, Team Bigfoot, the Society's 70-member field operation, has collected what Mullis describes as, quote, "extensive evidence of Bigfoot's presence, like footprints and hair, that has helped researchers to figure out the creature's features. Talk about a creature feature, huh? Now, a main goal of the team, which includes experts in genetics, primates, zoology, and biology from the United States, Canada, Britain, Russia, and Australia, is to classify Bigfoot among animal species. Bigfoot are related to both humans and apes. Their hair is similar to that of humans, and they walk like humans, but they have long arms and short legs like apes." Now, an interesting statement. Their hair is similar to that of humans, and they walk like humans. I guess they're talking about the descriptions of the hair, rather than samples that maybe have been collected, because, again, there are probably numerous groups out there that would still maintain that they have samples of what are believed to be, at least by the people who hold these samples, evidence of Bigfoot. But if we look at Brian Sykes' study, it would seem to me that there is no genetic proof, as of yet, that constitutes evidence of a mystery primate. And so that's not to say that not anyone out there could possibly have it, but yet we don't have that, at least as recognized officially by academic institutions. Although the name Bigfoot has been used since the late 1950s, Mullis said that there have been documented sightings and encounters with the beasts all around the world for more than 1,000 years. And that is something that's interesting. I even brought it up during a recent interview, talking about the woodwoses of European folklore dating back to the Middle Ages. There are reports of wild men covered in hair, you know, that are taken from all parts of the world: Ireland, China, Russia, South America, Africa. You know, there are strange reports of man-like beasts literally from all over the world, and in some of the least likely places, the most inaccessible regions. You know, the Himalayas, of course, with the long history of the Yeti that supposedly lives there. Now, I personally don't have as much faith in the idea of there being a Yeti as I do of there being a Bigfoot. But the idea of the Bigfoot, to me, is quite compelling. And there are people who would think I'm crazy to say that. But, you know, I know, speaking of other skeptical-minded people who are interested in this, you know, Sharon Hill also has taken great interest in Bigfoot at times. And I think that, you know, while she, again, is takes a more popular skeptical attitude, popular in the sense of modern skepticism, you know, one of the arguments that she always has is not, okay, there's not a Bigfoot, but why aren't there more really good crypto books that rather than just, you know, telling stories and things like this, that actually address in a scientific and in a reasoning manner the idea that, okay, not only that a Bigfoot could exist, but maybe this is how we can go about trying to determine it. And I said to her in response to that one time, she put it up on Twitter, and I said, you know, Sharon, do you recall John Napier's book on this? And she says, it's been years, I don't really remember it, and I'll have to reread it. And I told her, I said, if you want a good book that also takes a skeptical attitude, you know, read that. Because in that book, at the end, again, John Napier actually comes to that determination that the anecdotal evidence has to account for something. And he always made that even what I would consider a slightly eerie statement, that it may not be all it's cracked up to be, but there's got to be something to it, which has always gotten me thinking. It may not be all that it's cracked up to be. Well, what could that possibly mean in relation to a giant hairy hominid that purportedly exists? And sometimes I go back and forth in my own mind and question whether or not we're actually dealing with something that is maybe a lot more like us than like a beast, that this is something that is an awful lot more like a person, a human being. Several persons, of course, because obviously I don't think that there's a Bigfoot out there. You know, so it's a very interesting discussion to be had. And speaking of interesting discussions, again, the subject came up while I was talking with Jimmy Church last night, and it was rather interesting, and we got a little bit of audio from that we will revisit here and now.
Let's talk about Sasquatch, and nobody really wants to, and I'm on the fence about Sasquatch. I really am. But and ghosts and all of this phenomena that seems to be, as we start to peel away a couple of layers, possibly related, and we just don't go there. Science just doesn't care.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you brought up Sasquatch. Again, there is some very interesting literature in relation to Sasquatch, and recently I've begun to kind of change my perspective on some of that just as well. You know, I came into this like a lot of people thinking, oh, yeah, there's a Bigfoot out there, UFOs are aliens from outer space, you know, ghosts probably, you know, live in every haunted house. I've trimmed that back a lot, and I acknowledge there are phenomena. We don't understand what it is. Most of the so-called investigation of this phenomena is largely pseudoscientific and silly. But the underlying phenomena, though, although it may not be all that it's cracked up to be, there is probably something as evidenced by the consistency of these things in our culture. Now, Bigfoot is a good example, because you go to England and you look in, you know, you look in medieval literature and you have what were called the Woodwoses, you know, basically the perpetuation of the hairy man or the wild man myth. But what is the root of the myth? You know, is this really a cultural holdover from, you know, our ancient human ancestors and their interactions with the Neanderthal or something like this? Or is it a representation of a phenomenon that has continued and is still even represented by something physical in existence today? John Napier, who I think is one of the most intelligent commentators on the Bigfoot subject in the last half century, back in, I think, 1972, he wrote a book that had a real unique title. It was called Bigfoot. And Napier, he was a British primatologist with the Smithsonian, and he was largely a skeptical researcher, and he wrote this book, and he came to two fundamental determinations in this book. And one was that he did not think that there was very much to substantiate the idea of an abominable snowman, a yeti, in the Himalayas, but that with regard to UFOs, listen to me,
they're all connected.
I know, yeah. With regard to Bigfoot, he said, the anecdotal evidence, and he was actually the very one, I actually mentioned this, paraphrased this earlier, he was the very one that said that there is anecdotal evidence that must account for something. It wouldn't satisfy the hard physical scientists, the biologists, the physicists, the chemists. You know, this is not physical data. We don't have a body, but we have enough reports from credible witnesses that describe a phenomena that is similar from report to report enough that there has to be something to it. And his actual words were, and this was interesting, and I always kind of wondered what he meant by this. He says,
actually, you probably have an idea what he's going to say, and that's going to be a little redundant, but jumping ahead a little bit, the conversation does get interesting. In remembering an actual report that was told to me as a child, sometimes the stories are compelling, but we can learn an awful lot from them just as well. So we'll skip ahead just a little bit right there.
Proof available before us as of 1972, and still came to this conclusion that the anecdotal evidence seems to support that there's something out there people are seeing. And Jimmy, I feel the exact same. I have talked with people, credible people, really credible people and even close friends of my family who have said, I've seen these things. You know, one story that just blew my mind. I was probably 15 years old when I was told this, but there was a guy. My dad actually is an Episcopal priest now, and he's a real scholar. He's a smart guy, you know, can translate Latin, Greek, Hebrew, all these kinds of things. Brilliant dude. And the first guy when I was about 5 years old that gave me books about this subject, Ivan Sanderson's Abominable Snowman Legend Come to Life, and also Peter Byrne, the British Bigfoot researcher, he wrote a book called Bigfoot, Man, Myth, or Monster. And those two books were given to me at a very early age. And my dad, back when he was in high school in the 60s, actually played in a rock group here in Asheville, North Carolina, called the Satyrs. And the drummer was a guy named Bruce Smith. And Bruce still lives here in town. And I remember we went to visit Bruce and his wife when I was in my teens, early teens. And my mom had said, you know, you should talk to Bruce about the thing he saw out in Madison County. I said, oh, what's this then? What did he see? And mom said, you should just talk to him. I think it was like a wild man. And I'm thinking, a wild man? And so Bruce recounted the story to my younger brother and I, because we asked about it. And it's not like, okay, Uncle Bruce, tell us about the Bigfoot you saw. No, he said, you know, tell us about the thing that you saw. And he said, I hadn't thought about that in years. He says, my cousin and I were walking up the hill. It was after dark, or just after sundown. And there was a chicken house up on the hill that my aunt had said, let's go up there, you know, you guys go get some eggs, and I'm going to make eggs and biscuits and stuff for dinner. And as my cousin and I were walking up the hill, we see what we perceived as being a bear that was raiding the chicken coop. And so we start making noise and throwing sticks and stuff because we want to get this bear out of there. And he says that the thing came out of the chicken coop. The door had been opened. And as it stood straight up, it stood head and shoulders above the 6-foot-tall chicken coop. And the thing stood and looked at us, and he said, as it ran off into the woods on two legs, it began dropping eggs. And he said that the clearest things that we saw in the half light were that this thing appeared to be covered in hair all over, but that it had long, he said the hands were long and white, and so was the face, white. But that the hands were really crooked looking. He said there was something funny about them. They looked real crooked. And he kind of stopped at that point, and you could tell it was like it was almost unsettling or just baffling to him. He goes, for all I know, it could have been some crazy old man. I don't know. And that was how the story ended. A crazy old man covered in hair that stood, you know, head and shoulders above a 6-foot-tall chicken coop with crooked, wicked-looking, weird hands dropping eggs as it ran off into the forest. It was a weird story.
Yeah, you know, Bigfoot is a paradox. And yeah. I'll tell you why. For me, if ufology had the Patterson film, it would be case closed.
Mm-hmm.
It would be done. It would be over. UFO, yep, there would be no arguing the point. And the Bigfoot phenomenon has got the Patterson film in its corner. I really feel when I look at the Patterson film that it's real. It's genuine. There's nothing about that feels funky to me. We know when we're looking at something fake, and we've all seen Charlton Heston in Planet of the Apes. We know when something is fake.
Yeah.
But the Patterson Gimli film, you look at that, and there's nothing, there's no dead, it feels right, it feels natural, and I think it's genuine.
You know, it was an interesting conversation, and unfortunately the connection was a little weird, and so there's that little hum in the background. We'll end that now. But the Patterson Gimlin footage is very interesting in relation to Bigfoot. We've talked about it numerous times on this program, and I've mentioned that there is dirt with that just as well as there is some compelling evidence that is potentially being offered with it. And I think that in relation to the compelling evidence, one thing that we have to take into consideration is that, and this is something that's very interesting, the skeptical argument that has been brought against the Patterson Gimlin film has often been inconsistent. You know, I think that Jimmy went on to talk about how John Chambers, who had been involved with actually special effects with, of course, Planet of the Apes, had actually claimed that maybe that they had been involved in the creation of the suit. Philip Morris, a costume maker in Charlotte, North Carolina, had said that he had sold the suit to Roger Patterson. Bob Hieronymus, the guy who purportedly wore the suit, as described in a book by Cal Korf and Greg Long a few years ago, said that it was made of horsehide and that it stunk. And with all these different narratives, it's interesting that we can look at numerous different... Listen, somebody, look at that. This is what's really interesting to me. We could say that Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin, maybe somebody, maybe was lying. And we don't know if that footage was real or not, but we know that there's footage, and because we don't know if it's real or not, we can only say somebody may have been lying. But what we know without any question in relation to the skeptical stories that have emerged over the years, that without question somebody is lying. And how we know that is because there are so many different conflicting stories that are purportedly the answer to the great mystery and the great Bigfoot hoax of Bluff Creek. Think about that. And yet the skeptics still accept this as being proof that it was all bunk, based on the fundamental principle that, well, a creature like Bigfoot simply could never exist. We don't know whether Patterson and Gimlin were lying. They may have been. But we do have evidence that still is questionable. Questionable in the sense that it can both be questioned for being authentic and also for being bunk. And we know that some of these skeptical interpretations are lies, or that they are little understood, and that they piece together facts to try and make a case for the non-existence of Bigfoot, and for, more specifically, the hoaxing of this event. And in those instances, we find the skeptics grasping at more straws than the people who are claiming that they have evidence of something like a Bigfoot. Now think about that. Really think about that. It's interesting to me. I think it's a little bit of a conundrum, and intellectually, it's troubling that there can be so many conflicting opinions, and yet this is proof enough for the skeptics that there is nothing behind Bigfoot. I find very similar arguments that are made in relation to the Valentich disappearance we talk about from time to time on the show just as well. And after getting to know Rhonda Rushton and talking with her, this, of course, being the girl who had been the actual girlfriend of Frederick Valentich at the time that he had gone missing in 1978, you know, there are so many aspects of that story that are interesting that people generally don't know because they never took the time to go and talk to someone like Rhonda and ask her questions about it. And again, being a skeptical researcher, I'm just as skeptical of the skeptics who would make up stories, literally make up stories, just to be able to offer a counterpoint. And it's interesting because, you know what? At times, there are people on the skeptical side of things who are even more credulous with the argument that they bring to the table than the so-called believers. And they criticize the believers for presenting bunk, or for lying, or for making up stories, or for just believing, just being credulous on the whole, and yet they're the very ones who are really the ones who are making up stuff. That is incredible to me. And if they hear this, if you are one of my skeptical brethren and you hear this, remember it's not coming from a guy who's trying to argue belief. It's from someone who's trying to argue more skepticism. You could be more skeptical, and you could stand to be a little more skeptical when you offer these half theories and elements of stories that contradict one another and still maintain that it is your own variety of truth. Yeah, it may be your variety of truth, but that's a far cry, one hell of a far cry from being a truth that can actually be accepted objectively. Now, when we come back, maybe we'll get into this a little bit with Karen Dolan, who's going to be joining us. She is also a broadcaster, a commentator on the UFO subject, and a dear friend of mine. And so it's going to be fantastic to catch up with her a little bit coming up after this break. We'll see what's on her mind right after this here on the Graylian Report.
Is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Broadcasting around the world via the World Wide Web, I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Thank you so much for being with us. Here in mere moments, we'll be hearing from Karen Dolan. I know that she was having a technical issue here a moment ago, and so we've got a landline as a backup, and we'll just be waiting to hear something from her here in mere moments, no doubt. That's what you got to love about live radio, and it makes you think sometimes how some of these big-time shows, you know, like Coast to Coast, how they always manage to pull it together the way that they do. But there are, little hijinks that occur from time to time. I know that the one time our dear brother, no longer with us, Philip Coppins, had to announce that he was unable to go live because of some sort of a weird technical thing that happened. It actually occurred to him, and that, I think, presumably would have been his final appearance on the program. So imagine that. But speaking of Coast to Coast AM, of course, I'll be in Boulder, Colorado this coming weekend, filming with George Norrie and my old friend Tom Danhauser, George's producer, for the Beyond Belief program that George is doing. Really nice. And, you know, it's one of the few shows in terms of television these days that I kind of feel comfortable doing. And what I mean by that is that so much of these television programs, I had a great discussion with Lauren Cutts of the KGRA Radio Network yesterday about that. And I believe we're going to get Lauren, by the way, on the program because he'll be bringing his High Strangeness show back to the airwaves soon. And in addition to that, Lauren's also going to have a book coming out fairly soon just as well. But, I mean, he's a true 4TN, a really deep thinker. And he is a wonderful guy in general. And he and I were talking about this, and he shares my sentiments about the way that the phenomena, and I think a lot of people have kind of misunderstood my criticisms lately of the phenomena as being criticisms of the phenomena and the people who are adherents to it, i.e. mostly UFOs. Whereas, in fact, the idea is not to be dismissive of the people, and that's the problem, I think, that we face with this so often, is that, indeed, as researchers want to be able to promote their work, they want to be able to represent themselves in public and, you know, in front of a national audience or maybe even an international audience. They want to be able to promote their work, you know, for the betterment not only of themselves but also for the community at large. But sometimes that can be a trick because they go on a program and they attempt to represent themselves in a credible, clear, coherent manner. But unfortunately, sometimes what happens is that the credible and the clear and the coherency ends up on the cutting room floor. But that soundbite culture, and it's not just relative to this discussion. It's not just relative to the unexplained. I find it in all areas. And I even remember Wired Magazine about 3 or 4 years ago did this big feature on this. And they actually called it snack-sized culture. You know, where basically everything has to be kind of fed to us in little tidbits, little tiny little mouthfuls. Nobody wants a full plate. They just want a snack. And the snack is what you get on these television programs so often. The snack is sometimes the very best that you're going to get. What you could hope for is some real, credible, clear, and yet again coherent discussion about this. And so when I was talking about it with Lauren yesterday, Lauren Cutts, he had said that being a co-founder, and I should make that clear, you know, by the way, the KGRA Radio Network that I do my program on Monday nights, he had said that when he was a co-founder with Race Hobbs of that network, that the idea that he had had was to try and create and present a clear and also responsible dialogue, or to at least be able to offer this to people, a responsible dialogue to people about this subject. Because unfortunately, I think that the intention, they may be even interested in UFOs, for instance, people who produce television programs, you know, that you generally see. I know Nat Geo is doing another one now that they're going to look at a lot of these famous cases. But again, I think that even in the promotional materials they're talking about, hey, we're going to see if we can find the best evidence that Earth is being visited. I think at one point, I read a press release about this upcoming Nat Geo program the other day. And it actually says they use this term, invasion. That to me is hilarious. How do you justify a statement like that? And that just seems incredibly strange to me that we would if we're going to try and present a serious dialogue on UFOs or any similar subject, that we'd be using terms like invasion in relation to that, because last time I checked, we weren't being invaded. Now, as I'd said, I want to take this conversation over to our guest who will join us right now on the program, Ms. Karen Dolan. She is a longtime friend of mine. She has also worked in broadcast, and she is an independent researcher. Glad to have her here on what unbelievably is also her first appearance on the Graylian Report. Without further ado, I do believe we now have Karen Dolan with us. And Karen, that's what happens. You try and get someone on who can join you with a meaningful conversation, and then, you know, the inevitable universal thwarting occurs. So my apologies for that, and glad to have you with us.
I'm so happy to be on.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can make this last this time.
I'm certain we will. I am certain we will. Now,
great.
I've been talking a bit about these programs and the way that I think that television programs sometimes are not the best representation of the real serious subject that we call UFOs. Would you feel that you agree or that you disagree with that?
I absolutely agree with you. And they really do the field a disservice because there's so much real information out there. There are things really happening that are fascinating. And I don't understand why TV producers seem to feel that they have to change everything to make it somehow more interesting. You know, I have to feel that if they put the actual information out, people would be blown away by it. And, you know, there's so many good people doing really excellent research. And if they were just allowed to present what they're actually working on, instead of always having to have the obligatory, you know, night vision goggle shots. And there are just so many things that producers seem to feel like they need to put in because, you know, some show 3 years ago maybe had it. And I'm not thinking of any particular show. I pulled that out of my head.
Oh, sure.
You know, I mean, one show does something and it does well, and then all of a sudden the next five or six programs that are made all have to look and feel and sound exactly like that.
And you know what else is interesting?
It's very frustrating.
Yeah, and I also see this, Karen. In relation to one show having success with something and then everybody else has got to do it, it's kind of like, you know, we could trace the lineage of what we see on a lot of popular paranormally themed programs these days. And I'll actually say paranormally because I know that your research actually goes far beyond UFOs. So we may talk about a little else tonight as well. But
that's actually more what I'm interested in. But
yeah.
Yes, please go ahead.
It's well, you know, that's funny because I actually, again, widely recognized as a UFO researcher. I didn't come into this as a UFO guy, but I certainly have you know, if I'm, you know, I hope not to leave anytime soon, but, you know, I'll probably leave being known as one. But that said, yeah, we kind of have that in common. But, you know, I think it's the success of other programs in totally different genres, and they see this success and they think, you know what, we could bring an air of mystery and even adventure if we could do a themed, you know, a reality themed show on this sort of a subject. And so, you know, it's not all bad, but I don't think that it is the best representation of the research. But when it comes to research, when it comes to research and maybe researchers, you know, you're a person who's very passionate about a lot of these subjects. You know, who do you feel in the field right now is actually representing this extremely well? And do you wish maybe we'd get a little more press?
Oh, wow. What a good question. I have to say, I mean, first of all, there's a caveat that I've been kind of preoccupied with personal things for about the past year or so.
Sure.
So I'm a little bit out of touch with who's really big and doing things right at the moment. That said, I have to say that I love Jim Marr's work, and I don't see him in the media as much as I'd like to.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot going on. There's always new material coming out. There are always new people bringing things out, and that's wonderful. And I know that he's still writing and he's still speaking at conferences. But I personally, like, I don't see him on Ancient Aliens.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe I've missed it, but I've watched not every episode, but a lot of them, because I really enjoy that show, and I don't recall ever seeing him on that.
Yeah, I think
you know, he's more of a conspiracy government cover-up kind of person, I guess, but
right.
I would include him in that.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you really want to find one researcher who, you know, does good investigative journalism and good investigations and reporting fairly the facts that he finds, I would say Jim Marrs, absolutely, hands down.
Jim is a unique guy. Yeah. And I, you know, as you've met him, I met him years ago, and, you know, he is a real He's a real genuine person. I mean, he is exactly what you do see when you see him at the events. And his discussion about, you know, he can talk about UFOs, conspiracies. He can tie it all together. Very interesting fella. So, Nana,
he seems very much like the late Ivan Sanderson, who also did some pretty amazing work.
He did, yeah.
And who had this unique way of looking at outrageous happenings and totally just unexplainable, completely out there facts, and saying, okay, well, what could logically be the cause of this?
Yeah.
And he could be so completely open-minded and logical at the same time. It was just brilliant. You know, very few people can do that.
It's so funny because, you know, Karen, you say, and every time you and I get an opportunity to catch up and talk, we pick up where we last left off. And I find it funny and almost ironic that you say that, oh, you know, I haven't kept up with a lot of the new faces and whatnot. But if I'm to bring anything to this discussion, I'd think that I would prefer to talk about people like Sanderson, you know,
yeah,
because again, you know,
I know it's much more like, well, who was doing it, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Yeah.
I can tell you about those.
Yeah. But look at what he contributed. I'm going to tell you something. You know, in the last hour, we were talking about Bigfoot a bit. And that actually, I had said then, and I'll say it now, I want to talk to you about that just as well. But Sanderson's book, Abominable Snowman: Legend Come to Life, to me remains maybe the definitive book. I think that was written in the mid-60s. And it's still to this, after all these years, remains the definitive book that actually looks all around the world based on real research, real correspondences, real field work that he did, that examines this not only as like Bigfoot in North America, the you know, the Himalayan Yeti. It is a global phenomenon. There's not been another book quite that matches that, in my opinion, and it's incredible that someone like Sanderson came along. You'd think eventually somebody else would come along, maybe who would come close to really canvassing the entire world and bringing a zoological scientific perspective to that subject, but I don't know that anyone really has come quite as close as he has to really making a good case for the existence of some sorts of, or maybe several sorts of creatures akin to what we call Bigfoot.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there are people who are doing terrific work in it. You know, I'm very impressed with Lauren Coleman and his books. But yeah, you're right. I'm just trying to think of anyone else who has done that sort of thing. And getting back to what I was saying about, you know, Jim Mars, he did something unusual and similar to Ivan Sanderson when he wrote his book Alien Agenda, where he pulled a lot of different things together and said, well, maybe this phenomenon is part of it, and maybe this is part of it, and maybe that. And, you know, he was able to look at the big picture and kind of put everything in context, which I think not very many people are really interested in doing. And I don't mean to say that that's a bad thing, because a researcher who has the ability to focus on a very small area and dig and dig and dig and dig very deeply, they're the ones who come out with the new information.
I think so.
You know, and sometimes it takes that kind of focus and years of focusing on one thing, one case, and that's where you get really valuable information. But then I think someone else in the field has to be able to take this new information that other people are unearthing and look at all of it together and say, okay, what does this mean to all of us? You know, as a human race, what does this mean about what's going on in the world?
That is spot on right there, Karen. Did you happen to catch Jacques Vallée when he went on Coast to Coast talking with it was actually George Knapp that was hosting that night. Did you happen to catch that by chance?
I didn't. I heard about it.
Yeah.
And I was not able to catch the show. I think Jacques Vallée is fascinating.
Isn't he?
He was one of the first who said, you know, looked at the old stories about fairies and said, well, maybe these are what we are calling ETs now. You know, the little people. We talk about alien grays being really small people, and there are all these odd things. You know, when you're in touch with them, time passes at a different rate, which makes perfect sense. You know, people who have contact experiences describe the same kind of thing. They go off on spaceships, they come back home, and time did not pass the way they were expecting it to.
Yeah. I think his perspective is very brilliant in that he is academic, and he would take something that would seem so apparently inconsequential as and harmless as fairy tales, literal fairy tales, you know, and look at this and say, wow, you know, but culturally these may be more significant than we realize. And it was Vallée, by the way, on that appearance that I'd asked if you'd happen to catch. I mean, he's saying exactly what you just said, taking the data that we have, looking at it and finding out if there is something more meaningful worldwide that we can learn in relation to UFOs. And it's so funny because there's so much collection, so much categorization, so much, you know, what would be the term chronicling, I think, of the phenomena, and yet there's very little interpretation done with the evidence. You know, what do you think we might be able to determine about various phenomena? Maybe we could start with UFOs, but if we were to take all the data that we have, what kinds of things might we find? You know, it really is an interesting question. You know, but I mean, I'd like to ask your thoughts on that. You know, what do you think that we might be able to learn, Karen, if we would take the time to look at the data?
Well, that's an excellent question. I would need to think about that for a minute. I can totally understand why there's been a trend toward this, the data collection end of it. Because, you know what, it's scientific, it's quantifiable, it's just collecting information, and it can be done exactly the same way data collection would be done in any other scientific field.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work for a cancer treatment facility, and they did a lot of research there. And watching the doctors who I was working with do data collection for their clinical research studies and trying to find out, you know, what are the commonalities between all of these patients with the same type of cancer? Do they all live in the same part of town? And, I mean, this is Rochester, New York. We've got Eastman Kodak here. There were certain neighborhoods where there was chemical runoff from some of the photographic plants. And it was causing high incidences of certain kinds of cancer in certain neighborhoods. That's the kind of thing that I'm thinking, if we can take all this information that's been collected and collate it and kind of put it in some sort of context, I can't even imagine, you know, what kind of forward steps we could take. I mean, would we start seeing patterns in the shapes of craft that we're seeing in certain parts of the country? Would we see patterns in, you know, maybe craft of this shape tend to be hanging around water, or craft in, you know, triangles near power plants and rods near lakes? And which ones are near more populated areas? Which ones do abductees and contactees report seeing most frequently? Maybe we'd get an idea about different groups that are coming here for different reasons and what they're doing. I'd like to know how they're interacting with each other.
Yeah, that's an interesting.
Because, you know, people, and I'm sure you get this at conferences, people come up to me at conferences all the time and say, okay, you've been in the field so long, who are they and what are they here for? I'm like, well, which ones do you mean? Because I think there's more than one group, and I don't think they're all here for the same thing.
I would even say that there's more than one phenomenon.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's that would maybe be something else that would be determinable through proper statistical analysis, would be maybe even varieties of different phenomena within what we call more broadly the UFO phenomena. So, you know, by the way, you know, and it's funny because we just jump right in, and you and I always have a lot to talk about, but I should play the proper interviewer here for a moment and take it back. You know, Karen, you have been involved in the field for an awful long time. You and Richard Dolan both. And, of course, I want to look at your work right now. What got you interested in this? What was the beginning for you?
Well, as far as my interest in the paranormal, it's very difficult to say what the beginning was for that, because that was my whole life. I mean, when I was a little kid, I always loved reading ghost stories. And, you know, my dad had Eric Van Doniken's books lying around the house when I was growing up. So there was just always this atmosphere of there's more to life and there's more to the world than what you can see and touch and read about in the newspaper. There's always something more out there. And I've always been fascinated by, you know, what is it? What's that stuff that we don't know about? I mean, ghost stories are interesting because there's an element of the unknown in it. There's, you know, what does happen after death? What are the situations, the conditions that allow someone to come back? Is it even real? You know, when I was a kid, they're just scary stories. They're fun. As I got older, I started to talk to more and more people who had had personal experiences. And I've never had a personal experience of my own. I've never lived in a haunted house. I've never had an experience that I could definitively say, you know, was the spirit of a family member coming back. I've never had anything like that.
And me either.
I've gone on ghost hunts. There's a really active ghost hunting group, and I hope I don't take that amiss. I don't mean it disrespectfully. I don't think they would like the term ghost hunting.
Sure.
but there's a very active research group here in Rochester, and it actually started around one of the meetups. And they used to call themselves Phantom Finders, and we changed the name, and I cannot recall what it is now, and I apologize to the group. But they're a wonderful, wonderful group of people, and they arrange outings to areas in Rochester that are allegedly haunted, that are have a long tradition of being haunted. This is a really old area here. We're right where the river intersects with the Erie Canal and empties into Lake Ontario. So, you know, Rochester was a real shipping hub when civilization was really just getting going in this area.
Yeah.
And also Mary and Maggie and Kate Fox lived here in Rochester. So spiritualism started here. That's still very big.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And there are a lot of haunted locations. Now, I've gone with them to several, and I personally have hardly ever seen anything. We got EVPs at the haunted Valentown Museum in my hometown of Victor. It's not too far from here. And I was blown away because I'd never, ever experienced anything like that. And all the ghost hunts I've gone to, and people would say, oh my gosh, do you see this down the hallway? And I'd be thinking, no, I don't see anything because I have really bad eyesight. No, I don't see it.
Oh, boy.
But I always wanted to see something, and I just never did. But yeah, we did get EVPs of, it sounded like a classroom full of children.
Interesting.
In a room. The room had about 10 adults in it, and not one of us was making a sound.
Huh.
But while the one man was asking questions, and outside during one of the pauses when we were waiting for the spirits to answer, I could hear a car drive by and turn on gravel right outside the window. And I remember thinking, I'm going to remember that, and I'm going to see if it turns up on the recording.
Uh-huh.
Because maybe he's got some pre-recorded sounds of voices that he wants to, you know, snow us with. So he turned the recording back on, and you could hear his voice asking questions, and it honestly sounded like a classroom full of little kids, all talking to each other. And then one child's voice said very clearly, let's go outside. And then I heard the gravel. I heard that car turning on the gravel, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, he couldn't have done that here.
Hmm.
I mean, in a sound studio where you can lay down tracks, sure. But not that. It was a little handheld voice recorder that was sitting on a table right in front of everybody. There was no way he could have done that.
The EVP thing.
So that's like, that's the extent of my, you know, supernatural experience.
Yeah, but maybe that's one of the more meaningful types that you could have. You know, I'm like you, Karen. I don't have those, you know, I don't have whatever it is, the gift. Yeah, I do believe that people see things that we might, that we might recognize as being the classical traditional apparition, the ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I would say about Bigfoot, I don't think that there is, I think that actually, I would word it like this, that there is enough anecdotal evidence, not only in history and in the mythology surrounding this, but even in modern reports that continue to come forth, where people say that they see strange things, apparitional forms and the like. There's got to be something to it. But I, whatever it is, am not someone who has had that experience myself. But the EVP thing seems really interesting to me. You know, what do you make of EVP? I mean, what are your feelings about it? I'm fascinated with it, and to me, I think that maybe there are at least a few instances, I think, that warrant further study. I mean, what do you think?
I think so, too. Absolutely. And, you know, going into it, I was completely open to getting results on this EVP. I had never been in a situation where anyone had tried that before, and I was hoping we'd get something. But at the same time, when I heard the car go by, I was really feeling like, oh, good, there's a control. Because some part of me still was trying to watch out. I was still trying to think, how could this be faked? You know, and just watching out for anything that could be done. And all I could think was, he could have pre-recorded something and then play it back and say, oh, wow, look at this. Even if he got specific responses to questions, I mean, he could be saying the right questions that he had previously memorized.
Sure.
And then just, you know, not record that, just hit playback. But there was no way that he could have faked the sound of that car outside.
Which you recognized and the minute you heard it.
Absolutely.
You knew
it was
what
very
it was.
Distinctive. A car drove. There was a driveway that came straight at the house that we were in until it got right under the window of the room that we were sitting in.
Wow.
And then it made a right angle turn. And you could hear that on the gravel. You could hear the crunching. And the whole thing took place late at night, so there was very little other traffic. There was almost no other sound. Everyone in the room was being totally silent because we didn't want to make noises that would obscure anything on the recording.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've even tried in my own experience in the past, I've tried to record EVP. When I wrote a book about a 1847 mansion that is still standing. It's been newly renovated, and it's gone through a lot, you know, over the years. But it's called the Reynolds Mansion here in Asheville, North Carolina. And if you ever visit, I'll have to take you over there sometime, Karen. I mean, it's incredible.
This, I would love to see it.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think ReynoldsMansion.com, I believe, is the website. You might just check it out. I mean, it's just a beautiful place. But there are 19 rooms, and I went from every room in the house, room to room to room to room, and tried my hand at recording EVP with a cardioid microphone, hoping to get results. No results. But you know, I've heard people who've gotten incredible things. You know, I'll just very briefly share a story. A guy named Mike McDowell, who was with a group called the Indiana Ghost Trackers, he came through Asheville a few years ago, and he played a recording for me that was taken at a purported Indian burial ground. And a voice was heard very clearly saying, "Sukumwe," was the word, "Sukumwe." And it turned, they went to a tribal elder with a Native American group there in that region and said, "Does this word mean anything to you?" And he says, "Well, it does to me," but he says, "That's not a dialect that is still spoken." He says, "Sukumwe, that word means Mother Earth." Now, directly before the word was actually recorded, a deep voice that says, "Sukumwe," like this, the question that was asked by Mike, and you hear this on the recording, he goes, "Why are you here?" And the native said, "The reason that that voice is saying Sukumwe, Mother Earth, is because that is the belief among our people that we actually were born of the earth." It was answering the question. And I'm thinking, wow, how would the answer come forth? If this were a hoax, how is the answer in a 300-something-year-old dialect, a Native American dialect, no longer in use?
Yeah.
It's just remarkable. Yeah. So I'm very fascinated by the EVP thing, you know, and I think that there's certainly something to it, you know.
I think so, too. I do think that, like anything else in this field, it's easy to fake, and I think there are people who, you know, some people are just playful with it. They just want to see if they can fool other people in the field.
Yeah.
And, yeah, okay, fine. I guess it's harmless. It's not completely harmless because it really muddies the waters. You know, I'm just kind of tired of people like that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want anybody to not have fun, but I wish they could go do it someplace else because it really makes the job of people who are serious about this a lot more difficult.
You know, that brings something to mind, by the way, and I hope this doesn't end up being a curveball because I really don't know very much about this. I want to ask you and see if you happen to know about it because I need to look into this. And I need to respond to his email as well. I've been so dang busy lately. I'm like you know, I'm just tired in the middle and flapping at both ends, and you just don't have time with everything else going on in the day to follow up on every email. But Goggs McKay, who is a listener and a from time to time co-host on the popular Paracast program with Gene Steinberg and Chris O'Brien, Goggs wrote me the other day. And Goggs, you know, he's got an interesting background in intelligence and whatnot, as he's discussed on the program a few times. But he emailed me and wanted to know my thoughts about something in relation to ghost hunting the other day. And he said that there's a guy who has appeared, I think, on the program Ghost Adventures. And he claims that he has somehow retrofitted an Xbox to be able to perceive anomalies in the environment. Do you know anything about this, Karen?
I've heard of it, but I don't really know anything about it. It's one of those things. People have been emailing me about that, too.
Really?
And it's kind of like on my list of things to look into. I would like to know more about it. There's something called a Frank's box.
Uh-huh,
and,
yeah.
You know, there are a couple of different boxes that don't seem to be all the same thing, but they're different ways of contacting the spirit world or allowing the spirits to contact us. I think they're fascinating, and I wouldn't be at all surprised to find that some of them work, but I haven't looked into them to find out, you know, which ones do work or how. And I imagine different ones probably work for different people.
Yeah, I would have to think so, too. Well, if anyone in the listening audience, and actually, before we go to a break, I'll put this out to people. We're going to return with Karen Dolan and discuss this, her life in the unexplained, and we may even take it in the direction of, you know, some of the other branches of the unexplained, cryptozoology. You know, I really actually enjoy, for a change, being able to discuss the paranormal aspects of this phenomenon. It's something I don't get to do often enough on this program. But I would put it out to the listeners, if you do know anything about this, because it's new to me, news, in fact, how an Xbox might be utilized in an investigation of the paranormal variety. But Goggs has emailed me about this. I plan to look into it. Heck, we could get Goggs on the program to talk about it sometime. He's a fascinating guest. I'm Micah Hanks, and speaking of fascinating guests, we've got Karen Dolan on the program right now. We'll continue our discussion with her when we come back on the other side of this break. It is the Gray Alien Report. Stay with us. Daniel Petit sends along music for us. This is a tune called Back in Dulce. It's always nice to hear music from the listeners, and there are a lot of them out there. He did this entire album that was themed, very folky, and of course he's in the UK, I believe, but Daniel's album actually features music that is themed around esoteric subjects, including Dulce. One song's titled Roswell. We've featured that in the past on the program. I'm sure we'll feature it again. Great to hear from him. And of course, if you are also a musician out there and would like to send along some music for us to consider here on the Gray Alien Report, info@grayalienreport.com. Now, please don't be offended if you don't hear your songs on the program. I get so many emails every day, I can tend to overlook a few, and it's not intentional. I just don't have a secretary I can hire who can handle all this stuff for me in the spare time. You know, Karen, if you know a good secretary, you know, you should really let me know, because I've got to get somebody to help out with some of this stuff. I know you're as busy as
Micah,
I am.
Well, Micah, I'm an awesome secretary. I'd love to come down and work with you.
Oh, but you're as busy as I am. That's just it. I figured you had two or three already. Oh, goodness. And as busy as you are, by the way, I'm so glad you were able to come on the program. It's truly just delightful. It's really delightful. Anytime we get a chance to catch up and talk. Now, I wanted to say, by the way, that we were already getting a little feedback from people in the chat room here. I was talking about an Xbox, and apparently that's not exactly what's going on. I'm trying to find the message here. Someone had actually clarified for me. It's not an Xbox that's used. I believe it's actually what's called a Microsoft Kinect, and that this can be utilized as a basic motion detector unit. And if I can find the message here, there's actually some really meaningful commentary that people are providing here. Yeah, it's a Microsoft Kinect that they say is utilized as a motion detector. Darzer in the chat room there just mentioned that. They also say Indrid Cold, a good friend of the program, and of course, you know, Fortean famous freak, I guess, you know, of lore and ancient times. He, Indrid, mentions that you can also hook up a cheap webcam to a Raspberry Pi and get a similar effect. Very interesting. So one more reason I love being able to participate in the Graylian chat room there. Now, you know, Karen, coming back to this discussion about, you know, the unexplained, there are some people who actually perceive, because I was talking about Bigfoot earlier in the program, some people perceive Bigfoot as being a paranormal kind of a phenomenon. You know, maybe something that is not entirely of this realm. Now, I don't know if I would go that far personally, but I wanted to get your thoughts about that, because a lot of people, more and more people are saying, and Nick Redford even suggested to me recently, he said, you know, Mikey, you should even write a book about the paranormal aspects of Bigfoot. Many people think there's something more going on. What's your thought about that?
Well, yeah, originally when I first heard about Bigfoot many years ago, there's this animal, there's this creature, this possibly undiscovered species that's living in the wild, and it was all very, physical nuts and bolts. Everything's very real. And I didn't even think about any paranormal aspect to it until once on my show, in fact, when I was hosting Through the Keyhole and I was interviewing Joe Fetch, who, that man, I want to say he specializes in this or that, but he doesn't. He covers pretty much everything, and he's brilliant. And just, we had a fascinating talk that covered so many different topics. And he started talking about Bigfoot, which I hadn't even expected to bring up. But he mentioned he's done research on Bigfoot for years, and he's spoken with very many people who have put out evidence that Bigfoot is actually telepathic. There are people who claim to be able to communicate telepathically with Bigfoot creatures that live near them. And also in the Skinwalker Ranch case that Colm Kelleher and George Knapp wrote about in Hunt for Skinwalker, if I remember right, there was something about a portal opening in the sky and Bigfoot coming through it.
Yeah, so, it seems like
everything. Yeah, so I would say if those are true, you know, the things that Joe Fex was saying and the things that Colm Kelleher and George Knapp were reporting, then I would say absolutely there's, it sounds like there's definitely a paranormal aspect to this.
You know, I wouldn't rule anything out. I know that when I was younger, I used to be a lot more apt to buy that perspective. In fact, I remember, you mentioned Lauren Coleman earlier, and I remember disagreeing with Lauren on that point that, you know, we cannot approach this subject, the study of Bigfoot, presuming that there is something, you know, transdimensional or something like that. We have to try and rule out the possibility that there is something physical going on before we can leap to that judgment. And I thought, oh, that's just putting a limitation on thought. No. I totally, years after the fact, understand what he was trying to say. He is trying to say that really, if science has ever got to take it seriously, you've got to treat this like the possibility is is a physical possibility that we're dealing with before we leap to something that is truly esoteric. But you can't rule anything out. And this has been an idea that's been among Native traditions. It has been an idea that has been among all different kinds of cultures since the beginning of time. You know, whether we're talking about Jacques Vallée and the fairy folk, or we're talking about, you know, these mystical creatures as represented by the Yeti, you know, in the Himalayas, you know, the Sasquatches, you know, in American myth and tradition, you know, there is the belief that there is something maybe more than just purely physical going on here. And you can't rule that out. I sincerely doubt that we have the full picture and that our limited reach of science, as we understand it, could answer all the questions that lay before us right now. Maybe one day, but we're just not there quite yet. But, you know, with regard to you mentioned Skinwalker Ranch and, you know, a Bigfoot coming out of a portal in the sky. This sounds hilarious to some people, but, you know, I do think that there are areas where strange phenomena, it's like there are little epicenters for phenomena like this. Have you ever been to Skinwalker Ranch, Karen? Well, that's eerie. It seems as though we've lost her. Well, how strange that would be, huh? You got to love it when that happens. In the midst of a hardcore interview talking about something truly strange, and you realize that your guest has been lost to time and space as a result of some sort of a strange, well, space-time hiccup. I guess that's going to be a term I'm going to have to coin for this kind of a thing. We're going to coin it a space-time hiccup that occurs from time to time that causes the disconnection of phone calls like that. Karen,
I'm not having very good luck with my equipment this evening.
I don't think it's you. I think there's something else going on. What I was asking you when you got disconnected, I don't know if you heard the question. I had asked you specifically, had you happened to visit Skinwalker Ranch at any point in your life?
No, I haven't. I've read the book, and I've heard George Knapp speak about it at conferences, but I have not ever visited, and I'd love to.
I'd love to go there, too. And to me, it's one of these places that seems to be an epicenter of these various kind of phenomena, you know, that occur.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at such a location, you may have something akin to, this kind of transdimensional trickster kind of stuff going on. There's some ufological things going on. Stan Gordon is a researcher who in other locations around the country, and specifically I think in Pennsylvania, has talked about Bigfoot reports in conjunction with UFOs. You know, what about the idea that we're talking about some alien's pet that's come down to planet Earth and is running around?
Well, I guess anything's possible. From what I've heard, the Bigfoot creatures, and I don't know what to call them. I mean, it sounds so condescending to call them creatures.
But, I agree.
Everything I've heard seems to be that indicating that they're much more intelligent than we give them credit for being. So I would sort of wonder, in light of other people talking about the alien grays, especially the short ones, as being sort of like little robots, little mindless, you know, household robot sort of things, I'd wonder which one is which one's pet, to be honest.
Good question. Very good question. Yeah. And that goes even beyond just the idea of there being mystery animals out there that may be far more intelligent than we perceive. You know, I've got a dear friend in academia who always says to me that, you know, we underestimate the importance of what we perceive as human intelligence and the idea that there are other modalities, other forms of intelligence that could manifest in nature, and that there could be animal species on planet Earth that really are the dominant intelligent species, but that we merely perceive ourselves as being that. He specifically cited... Go ahead.
Yeah, as a human race, we have always had, I mean, our entire history has been seeing ourselves as the center of the universe. Look how long it took us just to accept the fact that the Earth revolves around the sun.
Exactly.
You know, that the whole universe doesn't revolve around us. And we do have this tendency to think, well, if I haven't seen it, well, if I can't imagine it, then it can't be. And you still see that nowadays. You know, but we're being proven wrong all the time. How long did we think the coelacanth was extinct until a fisherman caught one?
Good point.
I mean, come on. And I remember when I was in college and I was studying physiology, one of my professors was talking about different animal species and different forms of life. And she said, you know what? There is a kind of marine worm that lives near volcanic vents at the bottom of the ocean in a place that we didn't even look for a very long time. Nobody even went there to see if there was any kind of life there because they said the pressure at that depth is too much. Nothing could live there. And anyway, it's too hot with the water being near those volcanic vents. And anyway, it's all full of sulfuric acid. It's like there's no possibility that anything could live there. So we didn't even go. And somebody finally did look. Yeah, there were marine worms there who live at that pressure and they live at that temperature and they eat sulfuric acid. So, yeah, what do we know? When I was running my show for 5 years, I got so much feedback saying, oh, my gosh, Karen's so gullible. She'll listen to anything. Oh, my God, she believes this could be real, and she believes that could be real. And I thought, you know what? They found those marine worms. Yeah, I could be wrong about anything.
See, I don't consider that gullibility, though. You know, again, I think that there are people, it's funny because people, I think, more than saying, oh, Mike is gullible, they will listen to this show and they'll say, you know, it's the strangest dichotomy with you because you'll talk about skepticism and the necessity for skepticism, like you and I, Karen, have talked about numerous times in the past. And then they'll say, and then you'll have somebody who's just talking about the strangest wacko theories. And the reason why I say that is because, well, first of all, to an extent, it's entertaining. But by the same token, we have to sometimes detach ourselves from reality and give ourselves to the possibility because we do not have all the answers. And it is, I find it incredibly, not only liberating, but I find it healthy to detach myself from time to time from reality and give myself to the possibility, nothing more than the hope, maybe even less than a hope that there is something strange beyond our perception. I'm blessed enough to be able to do that as a radio host. And speaking of radio hosting, you know, I have to say you've been doing this for a while. I believe that you had told me recently that your program, which you had done for a number of years, will be making a comeback soon. Is that correct?
I've been talking with my producer about getting back on the air again, yes.
I think you should.
I'm hoping to be back on soon.
I sincerely hope you will because, you know, Karen, you know, you've got one of those calming, cool voices. You just, you know, you always just you sound relaxed and you know what's going on. I hope you'll come back. I've told you this before, so it's nothing you don't know.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I've missed it, you know, and I've been wanting to get back. And honestly, it's just because other things have been going on that have kind of kept me away from it. But I'm really trying to pull things together and get back on the air soon.
Life returns. It happens.
And, yeah.
we've all been there. But, you know, I wanted to talk to you about that just a little bit, too. You know, the paranormal discussion. We've talked about television already, but radio is a unique medium to me because, or podcast. I say radio, but I mean that blanket term, radio, podcast, internet broadcasts, all these things. And what's interesting is it's not the scripted stuff that we see on television. It is a conversation, an ongoing conversation with bright minds from all around the world that really seek to present ideas. What have you learned as a broadcaster, as a radio host over the years from these kinds of dialogues?
Oh, my gosh. Have an open mind, really, and not to let things bother me when people in the chat room or people on their own blogs, where half the time I wouldn't see it, would say snippy things about how gullible I am. You know, I can't let that get to me. And it did bother me a lot at first because I don't want everybody to like me. But in the past few years, you know what I've learned? It's not everybody's going to. It doesn't matter what I do. Somebody's not going to like it. So there are lots of other shows out there. You know, there's something for everybody. And I just the thing I miss the most about doing it is finding a really interesting book about a new topic, something paranormal, maybe a new Bigfoot book, maybe something like, you know, Lloyd Pye's work on the Starchild skull. That just blew me out of the water. Finding a book like that and reading it and thinking, oh my God, I'd love to talk to this author, and then realizing I can call him up and ask him to come on my show, and I can ask him all the questions I want to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can have the chat room open and my listeners can ask questions and I can pass those along, and it can be like this big party and we're all talking to this person who has done this amazing research in this really cool area, and it's so much fun. And I learned, you know, that there's so much out there, because when you're putting on a show every week and you're constantly looking for more things. And I thought, darn, I have a total excuse now to go hang out at the bookstore in the paranormal section and just see what's out there.
Yeah, well, we all used
to. In the past, I always felt guilty doing that.
if there were ever ghosts anywhere, that's where they would be, because I haunted those book sections as a kid growing up. Now I haunt the science section.
Yeah.
But, you know, interests change. And that's what's beautiful about all this. Yeah, you do learn. You do change your ideas over time, the more that we learn. You know, what do you hope to learn in the future?
I would love to learn more about not just UFOs, but the beings inside them. You know, some people are really interested in the government cover-up. Some are interested in what kind of propulsion systems they're using. I want to know who's in those ships. Where are they coming from? Why are they coming here? You know, what have they been doing in their interactions with us, and what are their goals? And is it something we should be defending ourselves against, or is it something we should be cooperating with? I really don't know. And I'd like to know why they haven't been more clear on it. We seem to be getting so many conflicting signals, you know, and maybe it's because there are so many different groups and they really do have different different goals. Or, you know, it just seems like they're not all telling the truth, and I'd like to know why that is, too.
Huh, that gives me sincere cause for pause, Karen, because I'll tell you this. You know, for me, I hope it wouldn't be completely off. No, I don't think it is all. I would like to talk about abductions just for a minute, if we could.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
For me, I had gotten to a point with my own research into this phenomenon at one point that I began to say, I am a UFO researcher, and I study unidentified flying objects, not spaceships, not ball lightning, not mm-hmm. government secret craft. I am studying whatever unidentified flying objects may be, all of the aforementioned and none of the aforementioned, but I'm not studying abductions, because I began to realize that the abduction experience in certain circumstances, what we would recognize as being elements of the abduction experience, can happen with or without the presence of a UFO. But
mm-hmm.
you cannot deny the cases where people have seen an unidentified flying object, you know, descend from the clouds, you know, come mm-hmm. come close, and people end up on board what they perceive as a physical craft. The two most incredible cases that are also the most believable, I think, both incredible and also believable. Incredible in the sense that mm-hmm. they really stretch our brains and make us think about this phenomena, but that they are also some of the most consistent reports of this phenomenon. The Pascagoula abduction of Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker in 1973, and then Travis Walton.
Yeah,
you and I have both met Travis Walton. The thing that troubles me the mm-hmm. most, the most about that case, you know, he describes it as not a abduction, but as a rescue mission, because he believed that whoever was on board that craft thought that he had maybe been injured, and two, he saw human beings on board that craft. How do we reconcile with that?
I'm trying to remember what he said about the human beings that he saw. Were they also abductees or passengers, or did they appear to be, you know, running things?
That's actually a good point to address right there. Okay. He, because I happened to be in Eureka Springs, and he actually talked about this. The film, Fire in the Sky, presents this you know, kind of, it's a Hollywood version of the story where we have people who were, you know, even I think in the film there were bodies on board the craft. Scares the living daylights out of you, and it scared me when I was a kid mm-hmm. when I watched it. And he said that did not happen. He said he woke up in a technological environment with some sort of a device on his chest. He said that what appeared to be small humanoids with large heads, gray skin, and large eyes came up and approached him. He was terrified. and that he mm-hmm. grabbed an object and began to wield it kind of like a sword and tried to get them out of the room, and they left. And then a few minutes later, a human man appeared, or what appeared to be a human man. But he said that there were several of these humans that were on board this craft. He said that they were the epitome of their gender and wearing these kind of jumpsuits, and that they didn't say very much to him, but that they communicated with gestures. But he said that these things looked just like humans, just the epitome of their gender. They were very, you know, attractive females, and the men were very muscular. And he said that these humans led him off, and that they laid him down on essentially what was kind of like a stretcher, and that a device was placed over his mouth. He began to try and resist, but that the thing was placed over his mouth, and it was like anesthesia being administered, and he passed out mm-hmm. and had no further recollection of what was going on. But I'm thinking, yeah, unlike what we see in the film, he didn't describe people that were other abductees. He described people that were on board, the operators mm-hmm. on board that craft. So that's why I ask the question, how do we reconcile with that? It's just such a strange story. But to me, it has a ring of truth, you know?
Yeah, well, the first thing that comes to my mind is that these beings in other accounts have seemed to be able to put pictures into people's heads. They communicate telepathically, and they are often able to project images. They can not only disguise themselves, but they can project images of themselves into people's minds so that they appear any way they want to appear. Hmm. It strikes me that maybe they put images of themselves as humans into his head, thinking that maybe he wouldn't be as afraid, maybe he wouldn't fight so much if he thought he was with humans.
Yeah, a similar perspective was offered by Peter Robbins, who I visited in New York back in March, and he had said the same thing. Well, a similar idea. His idea had been that the human mind itself might have such trouble reconciling mm-hmm. with, just as I have trouble reconciling with, okay, what was happening there? Well, Peter said if the mind itself is so terrified in that kind of a circumstance, it may literally, we hear Whitley Strieber talk about screen memories. It could be a screen memory of that experience where actually what really happened was misremembered as being humans because that allows his mind to deal with it. Who knows? We really don't know.
Right. But that's part of the problem, you know, and you look at all of these. At the beginning of our talk, we were talking about different people collecting different information. And when you look at all of these different ones, it really seems like there's actually a starting lack of consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think of nothing so much as the idea of the trickster,
who
can really make us see anything, and they can tell us anything they want about why they're here. What are we going to say? What do we know? What can we prove? I mean, these accounts are so subjective. And I've spoken with very many people who have had these experiences. They come and talk to me at conferences and they want to tell me their stories. And there are so many who I really believe are sincere, and they're really describing what they remember. But I don't know, as you said, they may be having screen memories. They might be describing flat out exactly what happened totally accurately. Or they may have been deliberately deceived.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
And, you know, all of it. And this, okay, here's gullible Karen Dolan, guys. I don't know. I believe something happened, because these people who come to me, 9 out of 10, really do come and tell me their stories because they're suffering trauma from whatever happened to them. Something really happened and something really upset them. And, you know, a lot of these people will come to me and they want me to tell them that they're crazy. They want me to explain it away.
Mm.
And they would rather think that they have something mentally wrong with them than that this really happened.
Isn't that troubling?
It's painful.
Yeah.
You know, I feel so bad for these people, and I can't say, yes, I'm a famous mental specialist and I can tell you that you have this mental problem and, you know, none of this is real and nothing happened. I don't know. I mean, all I can say is other people have told me the same story, and you can see they go pale and their faces just fall and they're like, oh, it's real. Okay.
Yeah. And who are we, believer, skeptic, whatever, to say, you know what, I don't believe you. You didn't have that experience. That's the thing that I find. I couldn't tell you what actually is happening. I don't know from Adam's house cat, Karen, but I'll tell you this, that I know that there are people who are genuine people who believe that they have had some sort of an experience. And I don't just use believe in that context as an operative word. I mean They believe that they had something happen to them, and God knows what that may have been. So, and as far
well,
as...
And there's physical evidence in a lot of cases, which gets glossed over when you talk to the skeptics and they talk about sleep paralysis and all this. They ignore marks on people's arms and marks on their backs and, you know, grass that's tracked into their beds because they were outside barefoot. I mean, how do you explain that away by sleep paralysis? If they never left their bed, where'd all the grass come from?
You know, again, I always promote a fundamentally skeptical viewpoint on these things. And a lot of people take issue with the fact that, that I say that and that I'm even billed as a skeptical thinker. But I maintain a skeptic doesn't make up stories to explain their perspective, you know, on these things and then say that because they are not the ones making bold claims that their speculation is more justifiable than the speculation of the quote-unquote believer. Again, the skeptical perspective is willing to accept that there are unknowns and that we don't always have the answers. We don't have to make up answers so that we look like we know what's going on. And that is a fundamental to me. And yeah, sometimes we have to accept that, yeah, there are elements that are overlooked. And the reason why is because they're so strange and they haunt us with one thing, Karen, and that is that we don't really know all the answers, do we?
We don't. We absolutely don't. And that's why people like you and I are in this, because we don't know all the answers, and that's what draws us. That's what pulls us forward day after day after day. There's always one more mystery around the corner, and we want to know.
Yeah, it's one of many reasons, by the way, that I'm so glad to count you among my friends. Karen, thank you so much for coming on the program tonight. And before I turn you loose, any other projects coming up, you know, maybe the return to radio or anything else, and where can people find you online if they'd like to maybe correspond with you?
Oh, well, right now the best place to correspond would be on my Facebook page, and it's just Karen Dolan. It's K-A-R-Y-N Dolan. Hopefully I'll be back up and running online soon with the radio program. I'm talking with the Paranormal Radio Network on getting back on there. I don't know when that's going to be, so I keep saying, oh, hopefully soon. You know, it's something like doing this show with you tonight is just reminding me how much I love being on the radio. So,
well, I'm very glad for that.
You're inspiring me.
Good. So. Very good. You know, inspiration sometimes comes in the strangest places. And, you know, and I'm equally inspired. Yeah. It's always good to be able to talk with you. I hope I see you again soon.
I hope so too, Mike. I hope we run across each other at a conference or something soon. I'd love to see you in person again.
Well, indeed. But in the meantime, you know, we have wonderful technology that keeps us all in touch, and I will be hearing from you, I'm sure, okay?
Right.
Well, thank you again, Karen Dolan, for joining us on The Graylian Report.
Thank you, Micah. Have a great evening.
And you. A wonderful woman, a wonderful mind, and of course, Karen Dolan. She is you know, a wonderful researcher just as well. Always great to get her perspectives on things. So many perspectives to be lent on this subject. And a talk like the one that we just had always reminds me that we need to be willing from time to time. And again, don't be so open-minded as you know, as the saying goes, that your, you know, brains literally fall out of your head. But from time to time, be willing to disassociate yourself, I think, from the everyday rational and the presumption that everything is known. Because only in stepping away from it, I think, from times, as the old adage that I've discussed on this program goes, are we able to empty our cup? Do you remember that? Where the young neophyte goes and he speaks to the old master, and every time the old master speaks of something, the young neophyte opens his mouth and starts talking about how much he knows. And eventually the old master keeps pouring tea into his cup, says we should have tea, and he pours so much tea that the cup's overflowing. And the young man says, you old fool, you're filling my cup to the point of overfilling. And the old man says, yes, and unless, like the cup, you empty your mind, you will never have room for new tea. On behalf of Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, Jeremy London, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, John Anderson, and Dick Oakley, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, we bid you adieu, my friends. Until next time, as always, stay strange.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.